This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Over the course of history, the relative strength of states has been measured by tons of gold bullion, by millions of people, by the numbers of battleships or nuclear warheads. And when he popularized the term soft power, Joseph Nye Jr. suggested we also need to calculate the attraction of ideas and culture. As several rivals emerged to challenge the United States in the 21st century, Nye now suggests that the calculus of power is more complicated than ever. Yes, military force is important. So is economics. Yes, ideas and persuasion can be effective, too. But the cyber age and climate change introduce many other players, groups and individuals, as well as states. As countries like Brazil, Russia, India, and China emerge, how does the previous sole superpower manage the transition? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Later in the program, measuring a healthy diet, plate by plate. But first, Joseph Nye joins us from member station WBUR in Boston. His new book is The Future of Power. Nice to have you back with us on Talk of the Nation.
It's nice to be with you.
And I know your book takes a long-term view, which you call, and others call, grand strategy. But we have to begin by asking how the lessons that you draw might apply to the situation in Egypt today.
Well, I think what we see in Egypt is, and in the Arab world more generally, is a reflection of one of the two processes that I describe in the book, which I call the diffusion of power. And the diffusion of power is the switch of power away from all states to non-state actors. In an information revolution, there's just a lot more information and a lot more people have access to it, and that gives them more power. So it's fascinating to see something starting in Tunisia as a product of WikiLeaks and exacerbated, or if you want, amplified by Twitter and Facebook and so forth, and then a contagion transferring to Egypt. And there in Egypt, the Egyptians are trying to shut down the internet to keep it isolated. I mean, this is a perfect example of one of the chapters of my book that's on cyber power.
It's important to remember, not so very long ago, the media in countries like Egypt were limited to state sources, state newspapers, state television and radio. Yes, you could pull in the BBC, but there was no Al Jazeera. There was certainly no Facebook or Twitter.
Absolutely. It's fascinating to see, if you go back just not even a little over a decade, to see how much has changed in the plethora of information sources that's now available. At the 20 years ago, if you looked at the first Gulf War, basically that war was framed by CNN and the BBC. Today, there are just so many more sources of information. Al Jazeera is the main rival in the cable TV world, but the internet and these various forms of informal communication have become equally important.
And interesting that a country like Egypt has to have the ability, or believes it has to have the ability, to shut down the internet service providers and Facebook, as well as to try to control its own state media.
Yeah, and that's fascinating because they pay a large cost for that. When you look at the effect of this having on the Egyptian economy, the inability to have banks connected to the rest of the world, the slowdown of commerce, this is going to cost the regime a lot. So cutting off the internet is not cheap.
And it is an element of soft power, which, of course, cuts both ways. Yes, you can achieve some ends through soft power. And you cite, for example, in your book, the example of China and its hosting the Summer Olympic Games and how much it achieved by that and running it all smoothly. But you do things badly, and that can reflect badly on you, too.
That's true. It's interesting that in 2007, Hu Jintao, the Chinese president, told the 17th Party Congress of the Communist Party of China that China needed to invest more in its soft power. And they did very well with the Beijing Olympics in 2008 and the Shanghai Exposition this past year. But then they go and lock up somebody like Liu Xiaobo, the dissident, who was awarded the Nobel Prize, and try to prevent countries from going to the Nobel Prize ceremony. And they undercut all that soft power that they'd built up. So what you do domestically can do an awful lot to undercut or reinforce what you're doing or trying to do internationally.
And these sources of diffusion, we think of non-state actors as, terrorist groups primarily, as Al-Qaeda, but you point out it's a lot more than that. It's banks, it's corporations, it's individuals.
That's right. The range of non-state actors is enormous. I mean, at the benign end, you could say an organization like Oxfam that tries to promote development and feed the hungry, or a group like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation trying to cure diseases in Africa. These are at the benign end of the non-state actor spectrum. At the malign end, I suppose we would put Al-Qaeda and its brethren organizations who are highly destructive. And in between, you have a huge range of different actors. So governments are still the most important actor on the world stage, but the stage is just a lot more crowded because technology has reduced the barriers to entry. 20-30 years ago, if you wanted to have an international phone call that linked all parts of the world, you could do it technologically, but it was expensive. Today, anybody can do that if they have access to an internet cafe. And so it's very – the barriers to entry have just gone down dramatically.
But that's at the bottom level of a 3D chessboard, as you describe it, the level of diffuse power. There are other levels of power, among them the powers among states. And, of course, many of us grew up in a world where there were two superpowers. And, of course, the rest of us grew up in a world where there was only one. That is changing again, whether the United States is in decline or relative decline. You can argue about that. But certainly there are powers emerging with China and India as they, reclaim a place that they historically held in the world. But that was centuries ago.
Right. And if you look at the world in 1800, you'll notice that more than half of the world's population was in Asia, and more than half of the world's product was made in Asia. By 1900, that was still half the world's population, but only 20% of the world's product. And that's because of the Industrial Revolution in Europe and America. But if you look at the 21st century, what you're seeing is the gradual return of Asia, so it'll be producing about the same share of world product, over half, as its population. That's sometimes called the rise of Asia. It's actually the return of Asia. And it's a natural process. And it's obviously the rise of China. But before China, there was Japan and Korea. And after China, there's India. So this is a long historical process.
Some have looked at this transition and say the history of one great power being challenged by a surging power, and they would look at, for example, Germany and Britain, at the United States and Britain, at the United States and the Soviet Union. Those transitions rarely go smoothly.
Well, they often lead to disaster. If you look at the origins of World War I, many people would say it was caused by the rise in the power of Germany and that the fear that created in Britain. But it's also true that the rise of the United States, even though we'd had wars with Britain, did not lead to a war with Britain. So it's not inevitable. Now, there are differences between the rise in the power of China and the rise in the power of America, but there are also some similarities. I think a lot depends on how we manage this. One of the pieces of good news is that contrary to the views that the United States is in decline and China's just about to eat our lunch or overtake us militarily and economically, it's simply not true. Germany had passed Britain in its economy by 1900. Even by the most optimistic projections, China's economy won't be as large as the American economy until sometime in the 2020s. And in per capita income, which is wealth per person, that will probably not occur until well into the century. And that per capita income is a better measure of the sophistication of an economy. So unlike the German challenge to Britain, China, yes, they are improving their position compared to us, but they've still got a long way to go.
Let's see if we get a caller in on the conversation. Our guest is Joseph Nye, Jr. His new book is The Future of Power. He's a professor and former dean at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. He, before that, served in the Defense Department and before that at the State Department. 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. How does the former sole superpower manage the transition in the world of cyber communications and climate change? Let's begin with Aaron. Aaron with us from Dubuque.
Yeah, hello.
Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Oh, thank you. You know, I can't help but hear a lot of folks showing a lot of distress over the fact that we're rapidly becoming maybe not the sole superpower in the globe. And I just wonder if maybe there isn't cause to be optimistic there, because we've for so long held the burden of being involved whenever there was a natural disaster throughout the world, or policing the globe, or helping to quell, you know, negative uprisings. And maybe we can begin to kind of rely on some of the up-and-coming superpowers and not have the financial and social burden of those things. And I'll just end it. I'll take the comments off the air.
All right, Aaron. Thanks very much for the call.
Well, I think that's a good point that Aaron makes, in the sense that, you know, it's not good to have power per se. Power is kind of like calories in a diet. Too much can get in your way. But it is true that if a large power like the United States doesn't take the lead on dealing with issues, it's not clear who else will. One of the good things for the United States is we're particularly good at creating alliances and networks of organization. So if we have other partners that we can deal with and can help get them to help provide some of these burdens or share some of these burdens, yeah, it can be good for us. I mean, we shouldn't have a view that that every gain by China or India or Brazil is bad for us. In fact, there's some situations, climate change, dealing with pandemics, global financial stability, where we want them to take a bigger share.
Our guest is Joseph Nye. We'll have more about power in the 21st century when we come back, and we'll take more of your calls, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. We're also following events in Cairo very closely. We're expecting a speech by President Mubarak. The state television announced that he would be making an important speech soon. Many news organizations are reported that he's expected to announce that he will not run again for president and will step down as of September. Again, whether that's going to placate his critics and the opposition remains to be seen. But stay with us. We'll bring you up to date. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The Associated Press is reporting that a senior American official says the special envoy dispatched to Egypt by President Barack Obama told Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak the U.S. saw his presidency at an end and urged him to prepare for an orderly transition to a real democracy with elections. The official said Tuesday that message was delivered to Mubarak on Monday by Frank Wisner, a respected former U.S. ambassador to Egypt, whom Obama dispatched to Cairo amid mounting protests. Enormous crowds in the streets of many Egyptian cities today. The Egyptian state television says President Mubarak expected to speak on television to make an important announcement tonight, and many news agencies have reported that he's expected to announce that he will step down and will not run as a candidate in elections in September. Right now, we're speaking with Joseph Nye, Jr., the author of The Future of Power, most recently a professor and former dean at the Kennedy School of Government, a former official at the United States State Department and the United States Department of Defense. And you can read about how China's successful staging of the Olympic Games enhanced its soft power in an excerpt on our website that's at npr.org. We want to hear from you. As states like Brazil, Russia, India, and China emerge, how should the U.S., the world's previous sole superpower, manage the transition? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation at our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Joseph Nye is with us from our member station in Boston, WBUR. And I wanted to ask you again, one of the situations we had with Egypt was an understanding that this was a government which the United States had certainly supported over the past 30 years in the form of Mr. Mubarak, before that in Mr. Sadat, his predecessor. And this was a situation that everybody understood was fundamentally unstable. This was not going to last forever. And the U.S. government, not just President Obama, but his predecessors as well, have been criticized for not looking far enough down the road to ally themselves with possible forces that might emerge to replace the regime. But this is not just a question of Egypt. This is a question of many regimes around the world, and you think primarily of Russia and, of course, China. It was a lot of people were saying at Tiananmen Square this was a government that was fated to fall within weeks. Of course, it's been remarkably robust, but a lot of people argue this is not a stable government.
Well, it's true. The situation we're seeing in Egypt is larger than just Egypt. As you have this information revolution that I describe in the book, it means that information is available to wide parts of society that previously didn't have the power of information. This means that when you're dealing in foreign policy, you have a double job. One job is to communicate with the other government, and we still need governments. After all, Mubarak and his government were important in relation to the Middle East peace process in Israel and so forth. But you also need to focus on society, and you have to realize that what happens in society and how you're seen in society will have a big effect on your relations in the long run. And that ability to do two things simultaneously, to deal with governments and also deal with their societies that underlie the governments, that's not an easy task. And we've seen this in the last week or so as the Obama administration has tried to accomplish both these at the same time, communicating with Mubarak government to government and communicating with the society through various statements that the president and Secretary of State Clinton and others have made.
Well, let's see if we go next to Boris. Boris with us from Charlotte.
Oh, yeah, hi. I just had a question regarding China's buying up all the U.S. bonds. Basically, it's whether the guests think it's a strategic decision by China to kind of have an impact on the U.S. economy long term, or whether it was just financial, and what kind of real leverage does that have over time? Because you hear a lot about it, but you don't really understand, or a lot of people don't understand the real leverage that it can have over the U.S. economy.
Well, China does hold roughly $1 trillion of American money, mostly treasury bills and bonds. And people think, well, if China were ever to sell those, just dump them on the market, it could bring the United States to its knees. But if it did so, it would also bring itself to its ankles. So I don't think it's likely that China is going to try that. In other words, China is deterred from such an action by the fact that they need access to the American market. They also need some stability in that American currency that they have. And if they disrupt those, they essentially damage their own economy. And one of the things they're most worried about is inside China, maintaining a high rate of economic growth to maintain the legitimacy of this Communist Party structure that they have. People don't believe in communism much in China anymore. So the legitimacy of the party comes more from high rates of economic growth and nationalism. And if they dump their American dollars and disrupt the Chinese economy in doing so, they shoot themselves in their own feet domestically.
Boris, thanks very much. Here's an email. We've gotten a couple of calls on this as well. You mentioned the perils of Egypt cutting access to the Internet. Any comment on present legislation moving through the U.S. Congress to give the president similar power?
Well, I think that there is a bill in Congress about cutting access to the Internet in a time of crisis. It's not clear what that would mean in an economy like the United States or how you'd actually do it. We have many more Internet service providers. It's a much richer and deeper web. And it's also not clear that it would make things better rather than worse. So I've never been a great advocate of that bill.
As we look at the world as it develops through the 21st century, a lot of people look at the issue of climate change and see that this is going to be having, well, potentially dramatic effects. It depends on what you think the effects of climate change are going to be, but potentially disastrous.
Well, I think the science on climate change is pretty clear that things are getting warmer, even though we're suffering in Boston right now through yet another snowstorm. It's interesting that the Arctic is warming at the same time, and that the world this past year had the equal to its warmest year on record, though it's been nasty as a winter in the Northeast. But that means we do have to do something about climate change. And here we find that China has surpassed the United States as a superpower. It's the one area where they're ahead of us. They produce more CO2 than we do. And that means that we benefit if China learns to get cleaner energy. So instead of just thinking of this as pure rivalry, there's some situations where essentially if your rival or your other country improves its capacity, that's good for us as well as good for them. And in the book, I describe how you have to think not just about power over others, but power with others to achieve common goals. And climate is a clear example of this.
Yet you have countries like Brazil and India that argue you developed countries got to exploit the environment as much as you pleased when you were coming to great wealth and prosperity. Why shouldn't we be able to do the same thing?
Well, it's a good point. It's a historical argument. But it, you know what? Mother Nature doesn't care where the CO2 is coming from now. If we are going to suffer from climate change, and we will all suffer, it doesn't matter if it comes from China, Brazil, India, or the U.S. So the argument that somehow the U.S. May have been, or Europe have been, the source of a lot of climate, that's a lot of carbon that's out in the atmosphere now, doesn't solve the current problem we face. And that's going to take some pretty complex negotiations among the countries that we mentioned.
And a world of emerging great powers, not just one superpower or two superpowers, as we've become accustomed to thinking of the world, this is going to require a great deal of flexibility. And as you point out at the end of your book, an assessment of what our advantages, what our powers really are.
That's right. I mean, traditionally in international politics, people always said the most powerful country is the one with the biggest military. It's the country whose army will win. But it might be that in information age, it's equally important to be the country whose story will win. Narratives become more important. Doesn't mean that military power is obsolete. I mean, there are lots of places where it matters very much. For example, if you go to Japan or Vietnam or South Korea today, they definitely want American military power to balance what they see as the rise of Chinese power. So military power still matters. But the power of narrative, the power of soft power to attracting others, is becoming more important in an information age. One of the great strengths of the United States is we've got a pretty good narrative. Our values, we don't always live up to them, but when we do, they're pretty attractive. And in addition to that, we've been pretty good at developing alliances and networks among countries to help deal with the problems we face. So I would argue that, I do argue in the book, that the United States is probably going to remain the most important power in the next 20, 30 years.
Let's go next to, Rudy, and Rudy's with us from Cincinnati.
The question I have is regarding Russia. The Russians seem to be reverting back to old ways. You know, Vladimir Putin stepped down but really never left power. As the United States moves forward, our economy is revitalized, we pull out of Iraq and Afghanistan, are we going to continue to ignore the Russian attitudes towards, you know, democracy and failing to embrace democracy in its real form, or are we going to continue with what we've done in the past?
Well, I think Russia is a real problem for Russians as well as for us. In the book, I describe it as a country that is in decline, even if the United States isn't. Look at the fact that Russia depends primarily on one crop, energy, for its exports. Look at the fact that they have enormous health problems. The average Russian male dies about the age of 59. There's no other advanced country that has a demographic a health statistic like that. And demographically, the Russian population is going to shrink quite dramatically over the next 20 years or so. So Russia has a problem. And the question we have to ask is, yes, we have a real interest in Russia because they're still big enough to make a difference. They still have nuclear weapons. They still can be cooperative or uncooperative on issues like Iran. And in that sense, a healthier Russia is good for us as well as for Russia. Unfortunately, as I argue in the book, I don't see it happening.
It's interesting you mentioned, obviously, numbers, sheer population, a factor in world politics and relative strength of countries. Napoleon, of course, he used the great advantage of France's population to great effect for, at least for some time. But in any case, you have to look not just at numbers, but at the age, the demographics. And you mentioned Russia's aging population, also very true of China and Japan as well.
That's right. It's interesting. If you look at population in the world today, the United States is the only rich country that will keep its relative share of world population. Russia, Japan, Europe are declining in their share of world population. And equally important, as you mentioned, because of immigration and a higher birth rate, the United States is going to have more young working people to support the older people. And that's not true in the other societies that you mentioned.
It's believed to be something of a crisis here, but just wait. It's much more of a crisis in Europe and China and Japan.
I was going to say those other countries would love to trade for our problem. In China, the saying is, we're afraid that we're getting old before we're getting rich.
We're talking with Joseph Nye Jr., his most recent book, The Future of Power. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Here's an email from Bill in Larkspur, Colorado. I think one of the greatest soft powers is culture. American popular culture is tremendously popular in Iran, China, Russia, etc. This makes it harder for those governments to demonize Americans in general, even if they disagree with our government's policies. The same idea works for China in areas like traditional Chinese medicine. In our country, a TCM doctor in Colorado Springs cured my wife's incurable asthma in 6 months. Many people turn to this practice, and that changes many Americans' views on the threat of China.
I think that's right. Culture, particularly when it's attractive in the eyes of others, can be an enormous source of soft power. American culture has provided that for the United States, and I think Chinese culture can provide it for China. For example, if you look not only at traditional Chinese medicine, but you look at Chinese cuisine, Chinese art, and now China is developing what they call Confucius Institutes to teach Chinese culture around the world, those are good ways for China to increase its soft power. And, you know, an increase in China's soft power is not necessarily bad for us. If people in the United States find that China is not just a demon but has some attractive features, that makes us less fearful of China. And if we're less fearful of China, we're less likely to overreact and get into the kind of crises that you mentioned earlier in the program.
Well, let's go next to Matt. Matt Withers from Fort Myers.
Hey, guys. What's going on? Hey, I wanted to ask you, Joseph, especially about the idea of the United States' unique role in the history of international relations as a global hegemon. And I guess, you know, you guys are talking about other countries, you know, the threat of China or India or Brazil. But what I'm trying to ask you, what I'm curious about is there's been a lot of formation of, you know, stateless groups that have kind of had their own way of finding power, you know, through the Internet and through Twitter. And you know, we see today in Egypt's a perfect example of this happening. And I was just wondering what you guys thought about, you know, that the United States being such a powerful country and the rest of the world trying so hard to catch up, that they really can't do it through statehood. They're really trying to find another way. And I just want to know what you guys thought about that.
All right.
Well, we know how to deal with other states. We have military deterrence. We have diplomatic relations. We have economic relations. It's a lot harder to deal with non-state actors, the diffusion of power that I referred to earlier. For example, if a country like China or Russia or anybody wants to hurt us through a cyber attack, they can do it. But in doing so, they hurt themselves. In other words, as I mentioned earlier, bring down the American economy and you bring down your own economy. But if Al-Qaeda gets hold of cyber weapons, similar to the Stuxnet weapon which was used against Iran recently, it's hard to see how you deter them. How do you deter a non-state actor? And that becomes a much more worrisome problem than actually the problem of how to deal with the rise of a large country.
Matt, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, guys.
And Joseph Nye, Jr., we appreciate your time, as always.
I enjoy it.
Joseph Nye, author most recently of The Future of Power, and he joined us from WBUR, our member station in, as he pointed out, snowy Boston. And just to remind you, we are following events in Egypt closely. Egyptian state television still says it expects to broadcast a recorded announcement from President Hosni Mubarak. Many news organizations, including CNN and Al Arabiya, report that the president of Egypt is expected to announce he will not run again for elections, which are scheduled in September. Whether that will satisfy his critics, who have been calling for his immediate ouster, remains to be seen. Many hundreds of thousands, if not more than a million people, rallied for that end in Egyptian cities earlier today. So stay tuned to NPR News for the latest from Egypt. Coming up next, if you never really got the food pyramid, well, now it's a plate. New guidelines to measure a healthy diet. NPR's April Fulton will join us. Stay with us for that. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.